back once again. Give us the launch codes. I'm Tom.
I'm Travis.
And we're doing another FUCKIT. Oh, let me do that again.
Fuck it!
Basically, we're doing fuck it. I messed it up a bit, but we're doing fuck it, everybody. Fuck it! Fuck it, fuck it, fuck it. Let's just start off with a fuck it. Going right into it. No little opening. We just want to talk about something that Travis has never done or played or seen or read. He'll do the same for me. And I get to start it off this time. Thank you, Travis.
You're welcome.
I actually liked when you started off. It was just how you set the tone, but I'll do it. Let me start off with my fuck it. This is another video game.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to start it off kind of like I did with the Resident Evil one. Travis, do you like killing Nazis?
Are we talking about Wolfenstein?
We are talking about Wolfenstein.
Didn't we already talk about Wolfenstein?
I'm going into it, though, because it needs to be, because it's timely. Wolfenstein is started off as a Doom clone from the 90s, Wolfenstein 3D.
I've seen screenshots of, like, old Wolfenstein, and, like, oh, this is like Doom.
Yeah.
Did it come out before Doom, though?
No, I think it came out after.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a Doom clone.
Okay. Back when all FPS shooters were called Doom
clones.
Like the pre-Halo era where every FPS was a Doom clone.
Yep. Isn't it interesting how it went from Doom to Halo to, unfortunately, Call of Duty? Yep. Because Call of Duty started off great.
Yeah.
Wolfenstein is great. Now, to give you a sense of the world, basically Wolfenstein is set during, you know, World War II, and the Nazis just have better tech. That's all it is. That's really what Wolfenstein is. Now Return to Castle Wolfenstein and Wolfenstein for the 360. That's where it got, like, you know, like Indiana Jones, the Nazis are into the paranormal stuff and the dark arts and the occult.
What is a Wolfenstein?
I don't know.
what does that name refer to?
The best part is, I have no fucking clue. Like, I just like the name.
You said one of the games is called Return to Castle Wolfenstein. So
Wolfenstein's a castle.
Okay.
But the whole time of what Wolfenstein is, I think it's just a cool name someone made up. That's all I mean. It's really, it just refers to the castle or a fictional Nazi fortress.
Nice.
That's really just all it is. But anyway, what I specifically do want to talk about, even though Wolfenstein 3D, Return to Castle Wolfenstein, and Wolfenstein for the 360, play it. It's just you're fighting more the paranormal Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to talk about is what the Machine Games, what they did with Bethesda. Wolfenstein, The New Order, The Old Blood, and The New Colossus. We are not going to talk about Young Blood. It does not exist. It's that bad. Fans ignore that. It's so bad.
Oh, I love that.
But what's nice about this is with this trilogy, and I said trilogy for a reason, it reinvents Wolfenstein, and because the main character who you play, B.J. Blazkowicz, or his full name is William Joseph Blazkowicz, or known by his Nazi enemies, Terror Billy.
Nice.
They give him a soul. He's not just some, like, hey, we're just shooting, killing Nazis, like, you know, mentality. It's a deep, grounded, PTSD, almost PTSD-written man. Like, it's a well-written character. He's voiced by Brian Bloom. He's done a lot of other stuff. He's mostly in, when it comes to animated works and video games, he's played actually a lot of the Marvel characters.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and it's really great because this is how it starts off. And in this trilogy, it's very much alternative history.
Yeah.
And that's fucking phenomenal because it's all about the Nazis win.
Yeah.
And they win not just the war, they even defeat the Japanese, they win the world.
Yeah, okay.
They colonize the moon, and they colonize Venus. Just think about that for a second.
They become the Terran Empire from Star Trek,
basically. Yeah, and the way the game starts off, right off the bat, is him saying this, because he's sleeping. He says,
in my dream, I smell a barbecue. I hear children. A dog. These things, none of it for me. I'm moved by roaring engines, not lone warriors. come from the night.
Think about that for a first-person shooter about just killing Nazis, based off games where the character had nothing to him but just, hey, you just play this guy and you go around just killing Nazis. That's how it starts off.
Isn't the thing with BJ, first of all, just that name, BJ Blazkowicz. It sounds like if he was a Russian guy, he'd be like BJ Blastoff. You know?
he is in this trilogy alone, you kill over 1,000 like Nazis. You're just a killing machine. You're 6'4", just balls to the wall, just a fucking lean, mean killing machine.
And like the backstory is like BJ Blazkowicz is like a Jewish man, but he's like a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jewish man, and therefore he can pass.
He can infiltrate the Nazi compounds. He infiltrates Castle Wolfenstein. He gets through like actual like occupied America through Germany in Berlin. Mm-hmm. Like he can walk around the capital. That's the joke. Yeah. He's a Jewish guy who is basically the epitome of what a German Aryan should look like.
Yeah.
And he's kicking ass. But the thing about what's nice, why I'd like you, hopefully you can play these three games, is it's so heavy on alternative history. And it's like, Jesus Christ, we almost came to that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how the show is. The Nazis control everything. So much so that the infamous, the most famous Beatles picture of them walking on Abbey Road,
it's
just four Nazis.
Oh, my God.
It's that. It's like, that's how much they took over. They drop a nuke on Berlin. I'm sorry. They drop a nuke on New York.
I was going to say, like, the way this works is, like, if the Nazis figured out the nuke.
They did before us, and they drop it on New York.
I guess they had to make a Jew science exception, because that's why they couldn't finish it in real life.
Of course. But obviously, they'll never admit that. And what's nice is, too, when you play in the first game, in the New Order, you play through occupied Europe. And you get to go, you're in the heart of Berlin, too. In the prequel game, which is the second one, it's called The Old Blood. They do fan service by going to Castle Wolfenstein. There's some paranormal stuff, but you're still fighting the Nazis, and it's like, you know, might in the power. You see all these gargantuan mountain-sized towers and machine works. Like the German machinery was amazing. Like it is. Like the Tiger tank's phenomenal, mm-hmm. and they take that to like the 10th degree.
So wait, the original idea with Castle Wolfenstein was that it was like a paranormal place.
It's the paranormal division.
And what did Nazis have to do? Was it like the Nazis doing paranormal?
It's playing on the summoning? It's playing on the concept of, we all know that like Hitler put a lot of money and funding and research into finding religious artifacts. They actually did try to find the Ark of the Covenant. Hitler actually had the Spear of Long Ines.
Okay.
And so the game's playing with that fact.
Okay.
For the most of the franchise, this one is specifically just alternative history. They have better tech, which the Nazis did, but what if they had, like, just a hair better?
Yeah.
Like, they have giant-sized mechanical killing dogs. They have big men in big beast body armor, dual-wielding Gatling guns. They had jets already. It's kind of like the Man in the High Castle, like, with the way their tech was.
Would you call that, like, fashpunk?
Yes.
Like steampunk,
but it's fashpunk. Oh, it is.
Fashpunk.
Because there's a scene where you are in Berlin, and you're just like, my God, I can't even see the sky. That's how high the skyscrapers are.
Ooh, wow.
Castle Wolfenstein is reimagined. This is almost the size of Mount Everest. It's like built into the wall.
Okay.
Into the mountainside.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why. And then it's also, too, what's great about this game is, one, the gameplay mechanics are great, because the whole point of the game is you can decide whether to go in guns a-blazing or sneak around and stab, you know, quiet kills.
Yeah.
Play how you want. First person, great mechanics. The guns shoot heavy. And what's great about this game is you can dual wield, but when you're dual wielding, the recoil is horrible. Like, you have to aim down. You have to consciously aim your gun down while dual wielding and unloading. So if you, like, take pop shots, you're fine. But if you just spray and pray, you're actually, like, little, like a big, like a gun would. You have no aim. So that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to have these great deep conversations about war, fascism, freedom. Like, America is completely occupied. And guess who they have? Guess who the Nazis have helping run America? KKK. Like, and people are openly walking in their hoods. Yeah. People are openly flying the swastika. When you get there's a level where you go through the war-torn New York of the aftermath of the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting, the take that the developers took for what New York would look like, Nuke, the skyscrapers look like burnt trees. Like trees after a forest fire.
Yeah.
Think about that imagery, the steel and concrete twisted to look like burnt, broken trees.
It's like even after the nuke, the skyscrapers are so strong, like it doesn't obliterate the buildings entirely. The structures are still there.
Yeah, it really is eerie and haunting. It's so alternative history, too, that Jimi Hendrix is a character.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awesome. It's great. That's dope. You also, too, in the first game, the New Order, you get to choose a timeline. So you can choose who to save, who to choose to die, and that reverberates through the New Order and the New Colossus. Mm-hmm. It's, and also, too, the villains of this Wolfenstein trilogy are amazing. You got General Death's Head, who's basically the main Nazi scientist. And what's cool about...
It's a great name.
Oh, it's great. And what's great about his design is he's bald. And what's interesting about him, too, is he... When dealing with this villain for the first game, you can tell his evilness does not come from pure blood racial bigotry. He is just a man of science.
Nice.
So who would offer him live test subjects by the thousands to do his experiments on and further advance medical science? The Nazis. All his test subjects that you see and who he's dissecting and, you know, carving and trying to figure out how to enhance the human body, they're all the, you know, the gypsies, the homosexuals, and the Jews. He does not hate people. He just sees them as meat on a plate.
So it's kind of the romanticized horror of Joseph Mengele that, you know, he was trying to... He did all these inhumane things, but he was trying to further science. As opposed to the reality, which is he was just a hack fraud sadist.
Yeah.
but
this man really loves and is trying to advance science beyond mm-hmm. human comprehension. Mm-hmm. And you see, like, he has people... you never heard of that... what was it called? Eagle wings? That torture... You ever heard of that method? Eagle wings? It's a Viking torture method.
No.
So basically, you get the person's rib cage from the back and spread it out open like eagle wings.
Oh.
So you see that with countless bodies in his experimental rooms because he's breaking down humans to the molecule for new technological feats.
Yeah, that's got to be horrific.
Oh, he's these games are gory as fuck, mm-hmm. gory as hell.
Yeah.
But this is a villain who is not the standard Nazi of I want to kill everyone who's not. Pure blood.
Mm-hmm.
He is literally trying to advance science, and that's all he cares about. He's a great villain, and the thing is, when you're battling him, you can tell this man plays chess.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a moment at the end of the game where he's like the final confrontation, and he says to BJ, "You know, I will not kneel to you." And then BJ's like, "Fine, I'll gut you standing." And then while you're stabbing him like just viciously, he's like, "Ha ha, you're so gullible." Click.
Oh,
it's a genius villain. Mm-hmm. And the next villain you play in New Colossus, Irene Engel. And she's basically Hitler's main, like, general for America.
Mm-hmm.
She is definitely just a full-on sadist clown. Like, I honestly think, and a coworker told me this, only Amy Poehler could pull her off.
Ooh.
Because it's just, she's a little girl in the candy shop, but she is super racist and loves violence. And she's very sadistic. There's a point, too, where someone's trying to stop her from, like, killing people. And she's, I know, it's her daughter. She's like, "Mom, you just said if they gave up this information, you'd let them free. You'd set them free." She's like, "I am setting them free. I'm freeing her head from her body." Like, think of that as a villain. That's a great villain.
Yeah.
In the prequel one called The Old Blood, you face two villains.
Mm-hmm.
One, Rudy Jaeger, who is basically the German version of Drago. So Blazkowicz is 6'7".
Mm-hmm.
This guy's like 7'1".
Okay.
And he has a dog named Greta. And yes, Travis, he is an amazing dog owner, and he loves to make sure his dog gets fed. And you already know where I'm going with that. And yeah,
okay.
You watch him feed his dog.
Oh.
Yeah. You watch him feed his dog.
Okay.
Yeah, and his dog is scary. Big girl. And what's funny about the boss fight is the only reason why you have a boss fight with this guy is because you killed his dog. So he goes John Wick on your ass. But what's great is, by the way, you have to kill dogs. Like, it's brutal. But he, when he's fighting you, he's like this. You killed my dog. My little girl. She was my everything.
Yeah, I feel that. I get where he's coming from, man. Yeah.
And then
can't argue with that.
The second villain in that game is the most stereotypical German name, Helga Schrops. What's great about her, so she is the head of the paranormal division, like for believing in the occult, the you know, afterlife, zombies, ghouls, all that voodoo stuff. What's great about her is she barely survived the polio epidemic when for Germany decades ago. So what happened to her? She lost use of her leg. She's a gimp. She's a lame. She's one of those people you throw in the camps.
Yeah.
But because of her brain, so her body is useless, but her brain is so strong, they didn't throw her in the fire. And she got, and she became the head of the paranormal division. And she has a gimp, like she has the brace and everything, like the Penguin. Like she has that all and everything, but she is, it's her mind. That's how she sends her troops. It's how she battles. It's great.
Oh my gosh, she's like Mrs. Peacock from the X-Files, but if she was in charge of like a Nazi squad.
And sprinkle in a little bit of Professor Umberg.
Umbridge? Yeah.
Sprinkle in that woman.
Yeah.
Sadistic, cruel, but like, takes her time like a cat with a mouse.
Yeah.
She's not, she doesn't rush. And also just overall too, the game, it's these quotes that make you go like, how is this a first person shooter? Like take this for example. War is a disease passed through blood spilled by warriors. This was a tough one too. So in the game, they show you what the Nazis obviously did in World War II, but you know, time has passed. They show, there's a level where a Nazi battalion comes in and cleanse a hospital, like Schindler's List.
You watch it.
You watch it and you fight it. These three games are brutal in what violence, war, fascism, and what really did happen.
Mm-hmm.
There's like four levels in the hospital you have to fight through, and you watch everything. You watch them just kill everyone in their hospital beds. Yeah. And then at the end of that level, when you capture the captain to find out information, there's a voice of BJ in all three games has a lot of voiceover work, and it's beautiful. And there's a voiceover work during while you're watching the old woman who survives just start hitting this Nazi captain. She's an old woman. She can't kill him, but she's vigorously beating with her hands, just hitting him. And he says this.
And they grieve for their dead. Such raw sorrow. Can't partake. Mine would flood oceans. It would drown me. If I let it out.
It sounds like they put a lot of attention into those games. And it's New Order, Old Blood, New Colossus.
And the Old Blood is a prequel just to have fun before the New Order, and then it goes to the New Colossus.
Okay. So that's like the true...
That is the true
You want the ultimate Wolfenstein experience in those three games. Okay.
Because there's another scene in New Colossus when you meet another resistance fighter named Grace, and she was there in New York.
Oh.
And she survived only because she was underground in the subways. And she tells this little monologue about the aftermath, and she saw a little boy walking towards his mom. And she said his skin... The way she described it was pretty fucking crazy, and how she described it was all you could see of that boy was his skin drooping, like when a toddler wears an extra large shirt. Like, you know, it also talks about even though in the second game you drop two bombs on the Nazis, it still talks to you about the horrors of nuclear war. Think about that as a game, though. You have the horrors of war, what fascism is, what it means to fight fascism as a free American. And then also nuclear holocaust.
An FPS game can easily fall into like a pattern of like where each level is like an excuse to, you know, it's like, ooh, new environment. I get to shoot some things here. And the story is just justification. I think of like with Call of Duty, there's especially like the Modern Warfare games, there's always like the little marker, like, go here.
Mm-hmm.
Follow this dot, go here. Like, where you don't even really have to pay attention to the story to get the enjoyment, the proper
just to play the game. Yeah, no, I get you.
So I like it, like, if someone makes FPSs. Which, like, do people make that many FPSs anymore? I remember, like, in the mid-2000s, that was the genre. Especially, like, when the...
Everything was an FPS.
The 360 era, 360 PS3 came out. Like, yeah. You know, nowadays, I think, like, open world is the trend.
Yeah.
But there was a time when first-person shooters were the trend. First-person shooters or, like, cover-based third-person shooters a la Gears of War.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. But, you know, something where you had to shoot something. That was, like, the big video game trend, and not so much anymore.
And it's great because also, too, it's just, well, when we brought it up last time, Wolfenstein, and how topical it is today, first two games when they came out, fucking big-ass hits. Big-ass fucking hits. Everyone loved it. Everyone was blown away by what they did with just the character of BJ and how deep and complex and a poetic warrior he was, how they turned him into. And then New Colossus comes around and talks about Nazis in America and fighting that. What happens? Controversy. Yeah. For no fucking reason. And yes, it happened during 2016.
Yep.
And it's bullshit because look, this game is full. All three games are full of just unbelievable quotes for a video game.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't war, but a breaking of seals, the undoing of life itself.
Yeah.
It's a fucking first-person shooter game, Travis. Mm-hmm. And you have these deep quotes. There's comedy, too, by the way. Like, what's funny is you meet Hitler as a decrepit old man who can't hold his urine.
Okay.
And it's hilarious because they make fun of Hitler perfectly. And he's hiding away in Venus writing his big screenplay for his blockbuster hit.
Yeah, I like the idea that, like, he's just become... Like, does it imply that he gets dementia, and as old age, that as he got older,
you wonder how old and decrepit he gets?
Yeah,
when he walks into the room and he looks at these four guys who are auditioning for his movie, he walks over to his director and says, "Who the fuck are these guys? Mein Führer, they're the actors we shipped from Earth to audition for your film. Actors, spies. You mean Jews? Jews are everywhere. You can see them. You can hear them. I can point out a Jew anywhere." And then one actor gets up and says, "Mein Führer, I'm from Arizona." And then Hitler just stares at him and just shoots him in the face.
I like that take on, like, Hitler getting older, that he was just, like, mentally unstable.
And he even has some, like, awesome, like, gets you pumped speeches. "You take freedom away from the American people, you're playing with fire. And I intend to pour some gasoline."
Yeah.
So to make it simple, great first-person shooting mechanics for stealth and full-on combat. Great cast of characters. In fact, Jimi Hendrix is fucking in it. Yeah. And the way he goes... Dude, like... It's not a spoiler for you, so I like to say it. We know Jimi Hendrix died, right? In our timeline. In this timeline, he dies because the resistance movement, their underground base, got found. And the Germans, the Nazis, are funneling in the sewers, are funneling into the base. And so Jimmy's like this, "Go, I'll hold them off. I'm going to give them something that they can't get past." He closes the escape route for everyone to leave, turns around, starts turning on every single amp he has, because he somehow, over a course of a couple of years, plugged it into every audio speaker in Berlin. And you know what he does?
Does he, like, knock everyone out with super loud guitar music?
You know, he plays his version of the national anthem. He plays that as his last stand against fascism.
Hell yeah.
And when the Nazis bust in the door and they have the guns on him and he's just shredding it up, guess this is perfect. You have to listen to the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
"Wait, what's that in his hand? What kind of weapon is that?" "It's a guitar in his hand," but they say they reference it as a, "What weapon is in his hand? Shoot up! Because the fascist pigs, a guitar is a weapon. An American electric guitar is a weapon to be feared."
Mm-hmm.
Think about that as imagery.
I love when American symbols can be recontextualized as maintaining their patriotic meaning, but now as, like, symbols of rebellion. Like, you know, I'm reclaiming this as mine. I give this legitimacy, you bastardize this. I like that kind of stuff. That's great.
And what's nice, too, there's Easter eggs for the hardcore fans. Mm-hmm. If you go around your base, like your hub, you can play Wolfenstein 3D.
Okay.
It's in the game for free.
Mm.
And then what's a fun little kind of joke, but also homage, if you go to sleep in your bed, you have PTSD nightmares. You play Wolfenstein 3D in your head, in your dreams. But the joke is, you're not, you're, everything is the retro pixels.
Yeah.
But you yourself are your modern, is is the modern pixelation shooting that your character you're playing dropped into the 90s pixelated world.
That's funny.
So you have, like, you're playing your modern character, you get to slide, stab, quietly walk through, but you're killing pixelated Nazis. So it's like, it's showing you that BJ has trauma. Mm-hmm. He is a broken man. He has killed thousands of people, regardless if they're Nazis. He killed thousands of people.
Yeah.
But the joke is, you're dreaming of Wolfenstein, Castle Wolfenstein 3D.
Yeah, using the language of video games. That's nice.
It's a good game. All right. There's, I think you should play it. It's cheap. You can, and I say this, unfortunately, buy all four for under $20. Don't play the fourth one. It's so bad. It's so painfully, like, disrespectful bad, because the first three are just genuine works of art. I hope they make a movie of these three games, this trilogy. It won't happen, obviously, but I
not
say
in this administration.
Editor Travis from the future eating crow right now, because since we recorded this episode at San Diego Comic-Con, Amazon has announced they are developing a Wolfenstein TV show from the producers behind the Fallout TV show. Thought I'd correct that.
When you play the game, it's an Oscar movie. You're playing an Oscar movie. Death, crying, suffering, innocence, dying. You go, there's a concentration camp level because you get captured and you are in a death camp and they show it. Everything.
They go there.
There is no holds bar. They show everything. I hope you enjoy it. That's mine. You're next.
Well, for my next one, we're going to go back into space. But don't worry, I'm not going to get as pretentious about this one. I'm not going to make a declaration that this was some, you know, groundbreaking, underrated piece of drama. But it's still really fun, and you should watch it.
Oh, space and drama. Do you mean Power Rangers in space?
No.
Oh. Lost Galaxy?
No.
Oh.
I was waiting for you. Are you going to say a third one?
That's the only space Power Rangers I know.
You're not going to say SPD?
Oh, my God. I forgot. No, that's in space. That's how they sing it. Power Rangers SPD has the this is the theme song. Power Rangers in space.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was the only two.
Whatever.
I think there's only two.
So, Tom, what do you know about Stargate?
It's a really good James Spader movie.
It's an okay James Spader movie.
Well, it's not his best acting chops, but it's good.
It's an okay James Spader movie. It's only, as far as I'm concerned, its biggest redeeming quality is that it spawned a much better television franchise to come after it.
So and South Park makes fun of it. That's how you get to Imagination Land.
Do they make fun of the movie, or do they make fun of everything else? Just
yes.
The movie?
Yes. I'm going to say yes.
Okay.
For both.
So,
Al Gore's in it.
So Stargate is mostly a TV franchise that started as a so-so movie, and the TV shows went on in total, because there were three of them. I'm not including the Saturday morning cartoon. We're not going to talk about that show. We are one day and all the world, and together we overcome. Fighting evil through the galaxy, Stargate.
Hey, you're not including something like me.
I know, yay. I know. I was thinking about that. I was like, no. So we're not going to talk about Stargate Infinity. We're going to forget that. No, the TV franchise went from 1997 to 2011, and I counted it there for a total of 354 episodes produced across three different television shows.
That's pretty good for three shows.
But it started in 1994.
Yeah. Okay.
With a theatrically released feature film starring Kurt Russell and James Spader. It was the brainchild of Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin. If you recognize those names, it's probably because 2 years after this, they made Independence Day.
It kind of is filmed like Independence Day in certain spots.
Yeah, I mean, Emmerich directed it, and Devlin produced it. So, yeah.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
They are the creators of Stargate, but then it got better as soon as MGM told them to fuck off.
Hey.
The original premise of Stargate, it actually shares some things in common with the movie that, even though this came out before then, Atlantis: The Lost Empire, the Disney movie.
Oh, that's a good one.
In fact, I'm almost convinced that Atlantis might have kind of ripped off the Stargate movie, because the main character, the way they open.
Oh,
is
yeah,
like,
you're right.
It's kind of similar. It's like the main characters are basically the same. Like Milo Thatch and Dr. Daniel Jackson are basically the same character. They both have long hair and glasses.
Their haircut's the same way. They look the same.
But in the Stargate movie, you follow this guy named Dr. Daniel Jackson. He's like a fringe archaeologist. He believes aliens built the pyramids. And he's laughed out. He's running out of grant money. His career is in shambles until someone working for the Air Force picks him up and takes him to the Cheyenne Mountain Complex, where NORAD is based. It's up in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And they're like, hey, we have this ring device that we found in Egypt a long time ago. And we realize it's a portal device that could transport you to other planets, but we are having trouble figuring out how to decipher the symbols to activate it.
And we need you.
And we need him. And okay, he figured out that like each symbol actually represents a constellation, and if you combine six of them together, plus a last symbol which represents the point of origin, aka like what planet you're from, then you can activate the Stargate. Because it's like, I guess if you combine six constellations together, it indicates like what star you want to go to. So they activate the Stargate, and Jackson is partnered up with Sad Sack Colonel Jack O'Neill, played by Kurt Russell. Although in this movie, O'Neill is spelled with one L. Keep that in mind for no good reason. And they travel to a desert planet that looks a lot like Egypt. It's full of sand dunes. There's a pyramid, the planet Abydos. They meet locals there, which are very Middle Eastern coded, and they find out that the locals are oppressed by a parasite, a powerful alien parasite guy possessing human form who poses as the sun god Ra from ancient Egypt mythology. And of which at that point, then the rest of the movie plays out as my wife put it, the Brendan Fraser mummy movie, but with extra steps.
Pretty much.
Where it's like, we have to stop the ancient Egyptian god overlord guy. And that's the movie. And it's a so-so movie. It's okay.
Give my regards to King Tut, asshole.
When Emmerich and Devlin went to MGM, were like, hey, we'd like to turn this into a trilogy, MGM wisely told them to go fuck themselves, because this premise works a lot better as a television show. We want to make it a television show. So, which Emmerich and Devlin had no involvement in. Instead, Canadian writer-producers Brad Wright and Jonathan Glassner would oversee this TV show. And that came out in 1997, initially on Showtime. Because Showtime was a very different TV network in the 90s than what it is now. This is pre-Dexter, pre-Weeds Showtime. And it was called Stargate SG-1.
Right, okay, so now I'm
so, so, okay, so now it's like, okay, well, because, like, oh, surely the Stargate can also take you to other places, right? Not just the one place. Kurt Russell's character got recast with Richard Dean Anderson, who was best known at that point for playing MacGyver.
That's cool. I like that. MacGyver. MacGyver in space!
Of which, if you watch the show, you'll notice a lot of MacGyver jokes are made. Sometimes
like
it just
that.
Sometimes in how they solve situations where it's like, well, what if we combine this and this with the material surroundings we have? It's like, oh, we'll MacGyver ourselves a thing. And James Spader's character, Dr. Jackson, was replaced with Canadian actor Michael Shanks. And then they filled the rest of the cast with a kind of she's like science lady. She's like an Air Force science woman, and that's Samantha Carter. In the start of the show, she was captain. She later gets promoted to major, and then eventually, by the end, she becomes a colonel. It went on that long. It was on for a very long time. And then the last member of the team, which is what the subtitle SG-1 is named after, the SG, that's their team, that's their squad in the Air Force. The SG-1, you have a go, as their general boss says. The last member of their team is an alien named Tilk, played by Kratos from the recent God of War games.
That's so cool.
Played by Christopher Judge. And he basically plays the same character that he later did in God of War.
Boy.
He's got, yeah, that deep voice, that like that's how he talks on the show. And he's like, because one thing in Stargate, in Stargate SG-1, what they find out is that there are these other evil aliens posing as ancient Earth gods that are ruling over people and fighting with each other out in the galaxy. And one of them is Apophis, the serpent god. So Teal'c used to be like Apophis' general. His race was like created by the evil god aliens to like be their slave foot soldiers. And he eventually turncoats in the pilot and is like, I want my people to be free.
Tal Shakamel, I die free.
And that's like that was basically the main cast for SG-1 throughout most of the series run, which was a 10-season run. 5 seasons on Showtime, eventually moved to the Sci-Fi Channel, which is how I got into it, in which they go through this portal ring. They go out of the planets, fight bad guys. It's kind of like the best and least pretentious parts of like Star Wars and Star Trek made into one show, but set in modern times via a secret government program that no one knows about. And it is probably, I mean, the franchise overall is like the best piece of pro-U.S. intervention propaganda.
How it should be kind of thing.
that I've ever seen in my life, which is relevant because it was on while the war on terror was going on. Someone, I don't know if it was Rowan J. Coleman from YouTube that said this or someone else came up with this, but to compare this to Star Trek would be Star Trek's whole thing is like, we can't interfere with the development of cultures. We can't tell you how to be. We're not going to play God. Stargate's moral is, your gods are fake. Here are some machine guns. Let's go kill them together.
Kill your masters.
Kill your masters. Yeah, exactly.
I like that. So that's the first one, right?
That was the first TV show.
I like that.
And then eventually, they find the city of Atlantis. It's not on Earth. It's in a completely different galaxy. Because it turns out they figured out how to dial the Stargate where there are 8 symbols instead of 7. They activate 8 chevrons on that on the gates.
They got a skill tree perk.
So they found you need like a very special battery. Because okay, here's something I love about Stargate. It's my favorite like space opera trope. The idea of like ancient civilizations that have existed long before the present. Yeah. Halo has the Forerunners. Mass Effect has the Protheans. Babylon 5, there's a few different ones, but overall they're called the First Ones. So it's I call it the First Ones trope. Stargate, they call them the Ancients, which is really stupid, and you find out later that they had a real name that they call themselves, but they still insist on calling them the Ancients. But yeah, so it's like, oh, the Ancients were the ones who built the Stargates. Which means, that means they probably had a lot of really advanced tech. And occasionally they'll find some of that advanced tech. And then by the time you get to Stargate Atlantis, which came out during SG-1's 8th season, it's like, oh, it's the city of the Ancients. It's a whole city made up of this technology, and it's in another galaxy. Of which then you find out, okay, well, why aren't the Ancients here anymore? Where did they go? Well, many of them do this thing called ascension, which is a thing you can do where you can ascend to a higher plane of existence and essentially exist in sci-fi heaven. It's actually how SG-1 killed off, but not really killed off, one of their main characters because the actor wanted to leave at first. But then the actor wanted to come back, so they're like, they had that door open. It's like, well, he's not dead. He's just ascended. That means we could bring him back, and they did, and it was great. It was really sad, but then it was great when Daniel came back.
It's like Maggie from Walking Dead.
So there was Atlantis. Atlantis went on for a little while. It was on for 5 years. And then after Atlantis, there was Stargate Universe. And sadly, that's like the most divisive show in the fandom because that's kind of where they went full, like, dark, gritty Battlestar Galactica-y.
Okay.
Although I think actually you would like Stargate Universe because I think that's, you're kind of in, I know that you, your personal taste, you're kind of into that kind of stuff. Stargate Universe is great because it's like, okay, what if you went through the Stargate and you're like trapped on a spaceship that the Ancients built a long time ago and it is just driving itself? You have no control on where it's going. So, like, if it stops by a, if it stops in one solar system, you better get what you need from that planet in a specific amount of time, because when the clock strikes zero, you're going somewhere else.
This actually sounds like an interesting setup for a TV show.
Yeah, and it got like real. It had a really ambitious idea, which is like, you know, this ship basically exists to figure out like what created the universe. So philosophically, it was like, oh, this is a spaceship that's meant to find the existence of God.
Is it kind of like the way the monolith is portrayed in 2001?
Kinda, yeah.
That's cool.
It kind of touches on similar ideas.
So you have SG-1, Atlantis, and then Universe.
Yeah, and Universe got canceled after 2 years, so it's great to watch. So the 40 episodes, I did a rewatch recently. I rewatched all 40 episodes of that show, and I was really, really sad when it was over.
40 episodes, 2 years, 20 episodes a season?
Mm-hmm.
What?
On cable.
What?
On frickin' cable.
Bring back those days.
I'll just blame it on the fact that it was made in Canada, and they could just make that work in Canada, I guess. You get to know a lot of Canadian actors watching Stargate, let me tell you.
You know,
because they shot that in Vancouver.
Out of all the TV shows I never had a chance like to sit down and watch or just pass by me, for some reason, whenever I'm walking around a mall or just walking by something or you know, flipping through stuff, even like windows shopping and on Amazon, Stargate always pops up somehow. Mm-hmm. Stargate is always popping up in some way or another. I think I just got to sit down and just do it.
It's surprisingly underrated, even though it went on for so long.
300-plus episodes, it's nothing to sneeze at.
No, it's not.
And they're hour-long episodes, right?
Yes.
Yeah, this is nothing to sneeze at.
Yes. And that's not including that Saturday morning cartoon that has nothing to do with anything that only lasted 1 year. And that is not including the stupid web show that was like an origin story type thing that was super cheap and dumb. And it came out in 2018. Forget about those two things. Just the first movie, the three TV shows, plus the two direct-to-DVD movies that were meant to tie things up from the first show.
Are there Stargate books, too, if I remember right, when we're walking around Barnes & Noble?
Yes. I've never seen one in person, but I know they exist. Yeah, there were tie-in paperbacks that they made.
So this is a big-ass universe. A good piece of sci-fi, it sounds like. I like how you said it's basically just, you know, here are some guns. Let's kill the gods together.
It's also a really great example of like a TV show that goes a long time that evolves. So like when you get to season 6, well now Earth has a spaceship. We built the Prometheus and it's a space battleship. And that comes from like, okay, 5 seasons of traversing the galaxy, gathering technology, making alliances, and now we can build our own spaceship. We can build a couple of spaceships like the Daedalus, the Apollo. They name them all after Greek figures.
Now there are 2 of them.
And just so it's like, oh, now we have a spaceship or 2. Well, that changes a lot of things. We can do like bigger scale stuff. Another thing I liked, and SG-1 was the best at this, it was really good about tone too. And I think part of this was the fact that like when Richard Dean Anderson took over the role of Colonel O'Neill, originated by Kurt Russell, of which then O'Neill became spelled with 2 L's instead of 1 L.
It's O'Neill with 2 L's. There's another Colonel O'Neill with only 1 L. He has no sense of humor at all.
Richard Dean Anderson was like, his big stipulation for taking the part was like, I don't want to be a big sad sack like Kurt Russell was. Because I want to have a little bit of humor. I want to have some quips.
Have fun on the job,
They kind of overdo it towards the end, but he was basically like the quip machine. He was like, it was weird. He was like the lead role. You know, he's the military colonel man, you know, no BS, doesn't understand all the archaeological science jibber jabber that his teammates do, but he's like, you know, boil it down to me in simplistic terms and then I can make a straightforward decision on this. But he was like a quip machine as well. Like, he was the lead, but he was also the comic relief, which is really, really strange.
Right.
But, you know, another stipulation he had when he took the role, he's like, I don't want to carry this show on my back. I want to make sure that the other characters have equal, if not more, time than me, which actually became really important because at some point he started appearing on the show less and less because he wanted to like be with his family more. And they kept concocting excuses for why he wasn't there, and then he eventually left the show altogether.
But an ensemble show is the best type of show.
Oh, yeah. And that show did it.
Like the bear.
It was incredible. But as a and I think as a result of him adding humor to the show, sometimes there's some like really funny episodes or episodes that play around with ideas that, like, okay, if there's one episode of SG-1 I would say is like you should just watch randomly to like get into it. There's an episode in season 4. It's called Window of Opportunity. It's basically their Groundhog Day show. Something went wrong with the Stargate. Messed with the space-time continuum, and they're repeating the same day over and over again. And only O'Neill and Tilk are the ones that know it. So they're like buddy comedying the Bill Murray role.
That's awesome.
So basically, as they keep repeating the same day over and over again, they have to like learn astrophysics as well as like ancient language.
All into the dude.
So they can mess with the device from their last adventure to fix everything. And then while they do it, like they suddenly it occurs to them, oh wait, we can do whatever we want for a while and we have no consequences, and it leads to one of the funniest montages I've ever seen on TV. So it's like funny and fun and games for a while, but then it gets to the end. And this is a spoiler alert. You figure out like there's a particular person who is like causing this to happen and is doing it for very like personal reasons, because he's trying to use the time travel to get back to something that's near and dear to him.
Okay.
And once you get to that point, it becomes like real very quick and in a way that's not tonally jarring, which is like an amazing feat to pull off. And SG-1 was really good about juggling those two tones. Like it could be really funny, but it could also be super serious, and it will never clash. It all melds together well.
That's why good writing is important for a TV show. I like that.
And not in like a Joss Whedon, like look how self-aware we are kind of way.
No.
Like it's not like that. You know, I when I see like science fiction shows coming out in modern day, they're all high budgeted, and they all, the exception of Star Trek Strange New Worlds, they all got like the, you know, here's our big 10-hour movie plot. And I'm like, you know, SG-1 had a lot of running arcs, but it was one of those science fiction shows that could be epic in scope, but it was something new every week.
Episodic.
SG-1 and Atlantis, and even Universe, even though Universe was like more serialized than all of them, but even Universe, once it found its footing, it embraced that very well. And then the Sci-Fi Channel changed its name and decided it didn't want to deal with science fiction shows anymore for a while, so they canceled it. And MGM was going bankrupt, so that show was kind of fucked to begin with.
The Sci-Fi Channel has changed for the worse.
They tried to get their mojo back, and they do have some good stuff like Resident Alien.
Yeah. That's it.
That's kind of it. Or that's the only thing from them that I've watched, but
they had House of Kal-El or House of Jor-El or
Krypton. Krypton. Yeah, House of Krypton. No, I want that. Nah, we won't talk about that.
I like the show. So that's, I like that when it's it's a space opera, space drama, you said, but episodic, where the team's going through the gate every week. Mm-hmm. And then it just, but it's not like that's it. It actually, like a real life, builds into more. To build into Atlantis like the way you described, that's cool. I like how Atlantis 2 is, it's not on Earth, it's somewhere else.
It's somewhere else. The bad guy aliens they deal with on Atlantis are like way scarier. They're like these, they're kind of vampiric, where they like put their hand on your chest and like suck the life force out of you, kind of like
Temple
kinda
of Doom. Kalima.
No, I was actually gonna say Last Crusade, like when they drink out of the wrong chalice. And, like, you just age because they're, like, feeding on your life
That's
force.
Cool.
And, yeah, they're, like, way, way scarier than the Ghouls or even the Ori. Although my Ori is still my favorite villain. Yeah, there's a few episodes of Atlantis where I'm like, oh, I got to pause this for a second. I'm feeling nauseous because it's just conceptually that idea is like, eh. I think all three shows are on Amazon right now. Sometimes the movie's on Amazon, sometimes not, because the movie is like the most well known, so it kind of moves around the streaming services.
I think I saw it on Tubi last month.
Okay. Yeah. And then like the two direct to video movies, which I would recommend watching, there's Arc of Truth and Continuum, recommend watching those after watching SG-1 because it ties some loose ends. You know, Amazon owns it now because Amazon bought MGM.
Do you think they're going to bring a Stargate show back?
I know they probably, someone there probably wants to. I know there was Brad Wright, who was like, he was like the big, he was like the creator and the big creator and producer behind all the shows, him and Robert Cooper. But Brad Wright did, I know a few years ago he did a pitch to MGM for how to reboot Stargate, but then the then basically the purchase happened and Amazon bought it, and then that was, it's kind of the last we heard of that. I pity the person, the entertainment executive at Amazon that has to figure that out, because like you said, you only knew Stargate by the movie.
Yeah.
You only saw the movie. Most people know the movie. Not nearly as many people know the television shows, despite how long those shows were.
Oh, and they think they're going to just focus on the movie in a sense of the groundwork.
Well, here's what I say. Like, if you, I think the universe established in the shows is really expansive. And I would think there's a lot more opportunities for stories in those. Like, if you just continue from the continuity of the shows, and, like, that's your canon.
Right.
Problem is, people don't know that it that well. And it was such, like, a, you know, an escalating nature that if you were to do a new Stargate show, it would kind of require people to do a lot of homework by that, if you went that way. So it's like, oh, you would kind of have to go, if you want, like, less risk, more broad appeal, maybe you'd continue from where the movie left off instead. But there's not much to work with there.
Or even worse, because there's not much to work with, they make the movie the first season.
Oh, wow. It's like, just do a total reboot.
You know how they did, what was that baseball movie that turned into an Amazon TV show?
Oh, League of Their Own.
They turned the one movie into an entire just arc-driven,
yeah,
season of, like,
I wasn't
eight episodes.
A fan of that show,
but I'm just saying, like mm-hmm. that, like, that the first movie gets just lengthened and broken into an 8-episode season where it's like you got to watch beginning to end every episode, and it builds and it connects.
Oh, that would suck, because that's not what that, what that, that's not what, well, okay, if they say, like, fuck off to the TV franchise, then whatever, who cares? But it's like
they're just pissing on it now.
Yeah, it's Stargate. Because here's the thing with Star Trek doesn't have this problem, because when they made Next Generation, all they needed to do was just, oh, it's 75 years later. That was how they rebooted that. And every time they, like, rebooted Star Trek, it's like, what do we need? We need people in Starfleet wearing the uniforms on a spaceship that looks like looks like Matt Jeffries designed it with the saucer cigar thing. And then you could kind of pick it up from there, because there's some standards. Like, there's always going to be Klingons, there's Vulcans, there's Romulans, and
the Borg once in a while.
Some, depending on the era, the Borg. So it's like, it's easier to get into Star Trek with that, but if they were to try to, like, reboot Stargate, introduce it to a new audience, but include all the lore that the TV shows had that the movie did not have, that they, even though they built off the movie, yeah, that could be difficult. Like, that could be a difficult attracting new people, because it's like, God, it's all this shit I have to catch up on.
That sucks.
Although, I hope it's worth it. It's worth catching up on. It's just
worth to watch. It's just a lot of homework, like you said.
Yeah, my recommendation, like, if you're interested in this whole damn thing, here's the order. Stargate the movie, the first 7 seasons of SG-1, then, when you get to season 8, that's when Atlantis starts. I'd recommend watching Atlantis, or SG-1 and Atlantis back and forth in that order, because they had the same writer's room. And sometimes there are some things in one show that could actually pay off in the other show.
I like that,
if you're
I like that, I like
very
that.
Subtly. So do that until SG-1 is over. After SG-1 ends, watch the Arc of Truth movie, then watch the Continuum movie, get back, finish up Atlantis, then go to Universe. Done.
Okay.
I think that's the best possible experience you can have. And if, I don't know, and then just know that the first couple of seasons, like, there's some clunkers in for SG-1.
Okay.
But yeah, that's like
that's
a lot of TV shows.
Season, yeah.
That's a lot of shows. A lot of shows, like, the worst episodes are early on.
Okay.
That's my Stargate bit.
Thank you.
Indeed.
If you were to cast the main, I think it was, you said like this show is just four, right? Main four characters.
Yeah.
Who would you cast?
Like if we just redid SG-1 and what actor? It's like asking to recast the original characters for Ghostbusters. Like, how could you possibly ask me to, like, who's going to replace Bill Murray?
Who would be your team? Who would you cast as just a five-man team? Simple five-man is on you, like, for the Stargate actual team. Who would you like to see in this universe play the archetypes? Not the characters themselves, but the archetypes of them.
Okay, if it's archetypes, you need a lead colonel. You need someone to decipher languages, someone to do science, and then an alien that's like your guide, and preferably like a warrior type.
So that's four, right?
Yeah.
So who would your four be?
You know what? It just occurred to me. I didn't mention that Jason Momoa was in Stargate Atlantis. I didn't mention that once, and I should have. That was a horrible thing to miss because
he's Aquaman.
Yeah, he was Aquaman later. That was his breakout. That was before Game of Thrones.
Are you saying he's been to Atlantis twice?
Yes, he has. Yeah, I forgot to mention that. Yeah, that was like, that's a bit like, because I didn't talk too much about the actors in the other shows, but like, yeah.
Yeah, he's in that. That's cool.
Yeah, he's in that. He comes in like the second season of Atlantis, and he's like, he plays like this sort of rogue, he's literally called a runner, and they explain what that means, and it has a specific context meaning. But yeah, but he's like your rogue wild card character, and they give him the coolest fucking name ever, Ronan Dex. And he has like a gun. It's like an old Westerns, like the revolvers, but it has like the extra long barrel. It's basically like the space version of that, but it shoots like energy beams.
That's cool.
Yeah, he's awesome. And it's like, movie star Jason Momoa. He started on this show. I liked Jason Momoa before he was
clean,
cool.
Clean shaved.
No, he was not clean shaved.
I thought he was.
No, he had a beard.
Oh, he had a beard?
He had a full of beard and his hair was in dreads. Like thick fucking
awesome.
Dreads that would swing around when he'd go into action. And he wore like a leather trench coat when
he had the look already, basically.
Oh, yeah.
He was just Jason Momoa.
He looked like he'd been living in the woods for a while.
So who would your four archetypes be? Who would be the, you got the leader, the linguistic, the science, and the alien warrior guide? I like how a warrior is the guide, too. You don't really get that a lot.
Yeah, it's like who's going to be your, it's basically like, who's your wharf? Because Tilk was kind of like a variation on Worf, if you think about it. To keep it PC, I don't want the warrior guy to be like the only person of color in the cast. I don't know. You know, it would depend on the character. I would need like a character outline. I would need like, all right, what's their personality?
Do you think then that's what you're saying now kind of makes me think, do you think that's how well written this show actually has been? It's like you actually can't really kind of just say this and that. You actually have to do a workshop because that's the show. It's so tight in that way.
Yeah.
That's interesting because you think for a show, it's just like, oh, just throw this, throw that. What you're telling me is like, well, no, you actually have to sit down and workshop everything because the show needs to be this way.
I mean, I'll tell you this. James Spader originated the role of Dr. Jackson, but I can't imagine anyone else playing that role other than Michael Shanks. Just maybe it's because I stuck with him for 10 seasons. He's been on the show that long, but like, you know, because the actor made it his own. He even cut his hair. Like season three, they got rid of the long hair shtick. He's like, I want my hair to be short. So he got his hair. By like season eight, he's allowed to use a P90 along with his comrades.
Isn't Stargate where the P90s became popular?
Yes. Stargate popularized the P90s.
I think you and I talked about this. Like, P90s were a thing because of Stargate. That's why you see them.
Because they
can look futuristic.
Well, also, they were very... Actually, it was because they were very practical. The original... Because originally, they just had, like, MP5s. But they had the armorer who worked on the show... Like, he used to serve, like, I think, the Canadian Royal Air Force. And he was, after a while, he's like, the MP5s do not make sense if you're going out in the forest, of which they use the British Columbia forests a lot. Get used to those tall trees. Oh, yeah. every planet in the Milky Way galaxy and the Pegasus galaxy is just a forest planet, apparently. He's like, yeah, MP5 doesn't make sense. MP5's for, like, indoor close combat. So he was like, no, we need like the P90. We need something that's like multi purpose that can do outdoor and indoor. And they were able to, like, satchel, like, the way it's strapped, they could, like, do this thing where it's, like, the rifle's facing down and they can
rest
just,
on the butt.
They can rest their head on the butt, like, while standing up. And
that's cool.
And that played into the blocking later on in the show. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All hail the P90. As they say on the show, there's this great scene where they're demonstrating the P90 to, like, some alien rebels, and they show, like, the energy weapons that their overlords would use. It's like,
this is a weapon of terror. It's made to intimidate the enemy.
And they shoot it like a wooden block, and it, like, it burns a part of the lock. And then he grabs the P90, and O'Neill says,
"This is a weapon of war. It's made to kill your enemy."
And it, like, basically saws the block in half.
I like that. That's
and
awesome.
Like, oh, these are weapons. These are better weapons.
We're going to war. Nice. Ida, that's our fuck it.
That's our fuck it. Yeah. No, if anything, watch Window of Opportunity from SG-1. It's just a great standalone hour
of
television.
I like Groundhog stuff. Groundhog Day stuff. That's cool. I like that, folks. I hope you enjoyed another fuck it. Watch them. Play them. You know, hey, everything's cheaper now for what we're talking about, the titles.
We all need a break from the world. A break from work. A break from the news. That's what entertainment exists for. It soothes the, even if it's thought provoking, it soothes the consciousness.
What way to better quench your bloodlust than video games?
It's the legal way.
Yeah. And to watch U.S. military troops in modern day do cool shit without feeling icky about it. Mostly.
Without the Vietnam flashbacks.
without thinking about Iraq, Afghanistan. My headcanon is that in Stargate, like, 9/11 never happened, because otherwise I think, like, the entire show would change if they incorporated that. I'm like, no. The U.S. government would be like, yeah, you know what, we're just going to leave the Stargate program alone while we're getting ready our big hegemonic action despised as fighting terror.
You know what's funny? You say for you, like, in your head, like, 9/11 didn't happen in that universe. And in the Wolfenstein universe...
Well, it definitely didn't happen.
Because they dropped the bomb in 49, so they never got a chance. They never got a chance in 49. I look forward to our fourth fuck it in the future. Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Bye, everyone.